morning. It's 9 minutes past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network. Well, are gay and transgender activists advocating for policies that are hurting confused, vulnerable children? A national organization of pediatricians believes they are. And joining me to weigh in on this is Dr. Quentin Van Meter. He's the vice president of the American College of Pediatricians. Good morning, Dr. Van Meter.
Good morning. Good
so to nice to have you. Great to have you with us today. And before we get into the issue of gender confusion in our culture, I think it's really important for our listeners to know that when it comes to gay and transgender issues, many of America's major professional organizations have endorsed policies that appear to fly in the face of science and certainly in the face of God's design for human beings. And I think, Dr. Van Meter, many Americans don't realize that there are some very, very powerful gay and transgender lobbying committees within organizations like the American Psychological Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics. And these committees are directly involved with crafting policy statements regarding things like gay marriage and gay adoption and transgenderism. And you correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe the rank and file members of these professional organizations rarely have an opportunity to vote on these policy statements, even though many of them may completely disagree with those policies. Is that the case?
That is the case. The largest of the medical organizations, particularly I'm familiar with the American Academy of Pediatrics, has a membership of touted to be about 60,000 pediatric professionals across the country and around the world. And it has an executive committee, which is elected, but which is sort of politically put in place to forward agendas that are very much, I think, run by special interest groups. And the LGBT community has a very, very strong lobby in the American Academy of Pediatrics, as it does in the Endocrine Society as well. And these organizations put together policies. They do not really give an opportunity for members to have input, although the Endocrine Society, as a national organization, did send out to its members a request to review and give some input to the what will become the updated guidelines for transgender patients that they are currently putting together. But the committees are hand-picked, if you will, with special interest people who have a very, very strong agenda. And as such, the membership sees this go by. And unfortunately, a lot of the membership in the academic world, they're constrained by the political correctness, so that if they have a differing opinion, they are literally told to keep quiet or their jobs and tenure may be at risk. General pediatricians out on the street don't have that particular problem. Their jobs are not dependent on that, but they are also quite busy. All of us in clinical practice, you know, get up and just face the day's work and the week's work, and the last thing that we have time for at the end of a long day is to think about, well, I want to become a political activist and speak up necessarily against what I feel is a perverse policy put forward by the professional organizations. And so that's what the American College of Pediatricians is about. It's a small group of over 400 pediatricians and pediatric professionals who are very much like-minded in terms of our motto, which is what is best for children, not what's best for parents who have agendas or professional organizations that have agendas, but truly what is scientifically based best for the children. And we came up with our list of harms that we feel the transgender ideology presents to patients and their families.
Well, you know, I'll give you an example of how, you know, these small committees within the AAP have, I think, really shocked and surprised a lot of rank and file pediatricians. I remember when the American Academy of Pediatrics endorsed gay adoption a few years ago. And I happened to be going to my child's pediatrician, I think, within a week or two of that that policy statement coming out. And I asked her about that, and she had no idea. She had no idea that her professional organization had just endorsed gay adoption, which, as we both know, would fly in the face of science and research. But it's tragic to me that we have, you know, this huge organization that purports to speak for as you said, what, 60,000 pediatricians across the country, and yet really speak often simply out of, you know, a political agenda formed by a few committee members. So your organization said a few years ago, a group, as you said, of like-minded pediatricians said, enough is enough. We need to be an organization that stands up for what's best for kids and do it based on research, not on somebody's idea of what they think kids need or want.
That's correct. And it, what we do is every policy statement that is developed by committee is reviewed by the scientific review committee for verification of the references and the quality of the references, and then the policies are sent out to the entire membership for comment, open to every single member who is an active voting member, and allow them to give input back to the statements, and then they're voted on, and they must be passed by a majority of the membership before they will become a statement that is sent out or a policy statement for the college. So it's a very much, it's easier to do that with a smaller group, clearly, but, you know, we really want to be all inclusive in terms of our membership having a say in what they believe in. And we tend to be like-minded in terms of give us the good science. It must be good science, first of all. It cannot be conjectured opinion or hopes or wishes. And the crazy thing about the transgender ideology is that we have somehow in front of us an idea that transgenderism is not a disease. It was sort of voted on, if you will, by the American Psychological Association in their DMS-5 criteria to change gender identity disorder, which was a disorder, into gender dysphoria, which is a statement that says gender identity essentially is perfectly fine. It's the being unhappy with the way you're treated which causes dysphoria or unhappiness, sort of a mismatch, if you will. And they sort of subtly transmorphed the idea that transgenderism was a disease state into it's actually a variation of normal. Very quickly, this is picked up by the LGBT community and said, now we now have a class of people to fight for, and these are the transgender children, and let's go ahead and push the agenda to make sure that we recruit them when they're in kindergarten. We make sure school systems accept these children, embrace them, change the entire world around the child so that it looks good and pretty and accepting. And we see the local laws that are being passed in various jurisdictions to sort of make the transgender child feel like that's the normal. And as Dr. Paul McHugh, who is our sort of mentor from Johns Hopkins, said, you know, we are basically taking a disease state and making it a new norm and a class of people. He said, doing this to children is kind of like taking an anorexic teenager and saying, well, you believe you're very, very fat. You aren't. In fact, you're starving yourself to death. But because you believe that, we're going to create a class of people for you that protects you. And we're going to offer diets and liposuction to you as a treatment for your delusional vision of yourself. Mm. And that's exactly the situation with the transgender child. These children are not emotionally well. It is a disorder. And to treat it with like anything, you know, like a normal variant, is really child abuse. And that was the point of our statement, is that we really feel that we have somehow jumped the fence very quickly into accepting transgenderism as a norm that must be protected as a protected class. And indeed, what we've taken is diseased children, and we're treating them. We're actually suggesting in the medical community that the guidelines say you should actually interrupt their puberty so that they don't have to go through puberty. When the truth is that when they do go through puberty, the vast majority of these children revert to their natal gender because of puberty. So they want to block the natural process of healing and adjustment, if you will, and create a new class of people that we'll have to deal with some 30 years out. As an experiment. And, you know, this kind of thing was done back at Johns Hopkins back in the 70s with Dr. John Money, and I was a fellow in that program at that time. And we were aghast at what was happening with the adult transgender patients and what was recommended. And we just sat back and said, is this real? And eventually Hopkins came to its senses and shut the program down under the auspices of Dr. Paul McHugh, who came into the chairmanship at that time. So we saved, you know, the program was shut down in sort of a it was a situation for, with a big black mark on the surface of Hopkins' reputation that they got into this. It was well meant at the beginning, but it got out of hand. And here we are now with 40 plus centers across the country in the academic teaching programs that tout transgender medicine treatments and interventions. And it's just like mushrooms springing up overnight. It's a scary situation, and we just need to speak against that.
It's tragic, Dr. Van Meter, and we're going to talk more about these children and what's happening to them, what can be done to help them after this quick break here on the Faith Radio Network.
FM and AM 900, the Twin Cities Faith Radio.
What a great song for the day after Easter, huh? God's relentless love bringing us back to him. It's 23 minutes past the hour. This is Bill Meyer. We're talking about the fact that transgender activists have been promoting social and legal policies that are harmful to children. And a group of pediatricians, the American College of Pediatricians, has taken a very strong stand on this. We're talking to Dr. Van Meter, who is the vice president of this organization. And Dr. Van Meter, let me ask you, what do we know from the research about how gender confusion first begins in children?
Well, the Dr. McHugh speaks eloquently on this subject, and he and Dr. Kenneth Zucker are sort of the folks that speak from clinical experience and clinical research. It is thought to be disordered family that causes the child to have confusion about the gender, so that essentially all the families of these children have pathology in terms of the relationship between parent and child and perhaps parent and parent, and it sets up the child for sort of a confused need to assume a different gender role more aggressively, and not only when that happens, because every... You know, I think all of us who've watched little children grow up, little boys will do something that might be construed as a feminine behavior, and girls likewise in reverse. But the family will come and say, "Gosh, you know, let's move on to do something a little different," or they'll just change the subject and get the child back on track. But if that little bit of a need is something that is sort of fanned, if you will, by the pathology within the family, all of a sudden the little boy is pushed more and more and more into those roles of being, you know, wishing to be the female child instead of the male child. And you know, sometimes it has to do with sexual abuse, but lots of times that's not specifically what goes on. It's just a disordered relationship in the family and a need of the parent to have the child, you know, turn into a child of the opposite gender from their natal gender. And the needs are therefore met, and the parent comes in confused and, of course, remarkably guilty, but sort of buries that guilt and says, "I don't understand. My child says that they are the opposite sex, and what do I do about this?" The current trend in these transgender centers is to look the other way, assume that there is no pathology, and just get the parents to accept this in some way emotionally. Because there's a lot of negative feedback from extended family members who see this going on in the family and say, why are you letting your child act this way, or shouldn't you do something different? So the parents are then told that they must accept this and support it, and they're given the psychological counseling to be able to do that. When in reality, what Dr. Kenneth Zucker did in Toronto in his clinic for 40 years was to go deep down into the pathology of the family and untie these events and do everything he could to return the child and the family to accepting the natal gender as a very positive and natural concept. And he worked diligently to do this and had great success in doing this in a number of his patients. It takes a lot of time and effort to do that, but he was essentially the only person doing that on the continent of North America for a long time. In Boston, however, the transgender center there did exactly the opposite and just brought the children directly into their new gender line and sort of shored up the families and gave them the support that they felt they needed to accept what was going on without going backwards to the family. I've had some fairly interesting conversations with therapists who have done that with children. And they can't answer when I ask them, how many of the children and the families have you turned back to their natal gender? And there's just a blank stare. It's not done. And what we need to do is just support the likes of Dr. Zucker's work in a larger scale. But he actually had his entire program shut down by the Children's Hospital in Toronto, where it was set up, because he wasn't keeping up with the times and wasn't being politically sensitive.
Because the transgender activists put pressure on that hospital and said somehow he's harming these kids. And of course, it would appear that in many cases these advocacy groups have pretty much bought the line that this gender identity issue is genetic, when there's no evidence that it is. Obviously, there are a couple of extremely rare genetic disorders that can cause a child to be born with sexual development problems, but as I said, extremely rare. So in the vast majority of cases, these are kids that, because of, as you mentioned, of family dynamics, environmental issues, they have come to believe that they are of the opposite gender, and now we have these transgender groups doing, in my estimation, downright evil, because we're talking about, and I'd like to, we have to wrap up for today, but I'd like to have you join us again. We can talk about some of the things that are happening with these puberty blocking drugs and cross-sex hormones and doing things to these young children, these innocent young kids who are simply confused about their gender, to try to shoehorn them in to something that they were never designed to be. So, Dr. Van Meter, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate your organization that is really on the front lines of advocating for the best interest of children. And thanks for your diligent work in that area.
Thank you, Bill, for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
Dr. Quentin Van Meter from the American College of Pediatricians. We'll talk to him again soon about this very important issue here on the Faith Radio Network.